Hello, and thanks for listening to the New Books and Buddhist Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Scott Mitchell. How was Buddhism practiced in the American South? That's the central question of Jeff Wilson's groundbreaking new book, Dixie Dharma, Inside a Buddhist Temple in the American South. The book primarily is an ethnographic survey of the Ekoji Buddhist Sangha located in Richmond, Virginia, but it also, apart from being the first major book that focuses on a Southern Buddhist community, it also offers a new methodology for studying Buddhism in the United States, namely a regional perspective. Regionalism is a trope that's familiar to historians of American religion more generally, but folks who study Buddhism in the United States have been slow to recognize some of the methodological tools of this allied discipline. Jeff does a great job of bringing a regional perspective to the study of U.S. Buddhism, and this book offers, like I said, the first ethnographic survey of a Southern Buddhist community, and I think really opens up a new territory for future scholars to take seriously Buddhism in different parts of the country and how different Buddhists adapt to and change based on their regional locations. So, without further ado, let's get to the interview.
Hi, Jeff. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing well. Thank you, Scott.
How are things up in Canada?
Things are lovely. Unexpectedly hot and dry. I guess up here we don't worry about the global warming quite as much. We perhaps applaud it and desire it.
Sort of looking forward to a bit more balmy weather, I suppose.
Yes, that's right. Although apparently as the ice packs melt, it forces all the polar bears south. So when they show up in my backyard, I might be singing a different tune.
Right. You have a slightly different worry than those of us who live very near the ocean.
That's right.
I want to welcome you to the show and say that Jeff's book is called Dixie Dharma, Inside a Buddhist Temple in the American South. It's, I think, a really great book, and I think it raises two very important issues. The first, of course, is your methodological perspective of bringing a perspective of regionalism to the study of Buddhism in the United States. And also, it's the first, if not the only, ethnographic survey of a Buddhist community in the American South, which is pretty interesting. So that's what we'll be talking about today. But before we get into the book proper, as is our way here on the show, I always ask about your background, Jeff, and how you came to the study of Buddhism, but also how you came to decide to write this book.
Okay, very good. Thanks very much for having me on, Scott. And in terms of my background and how I got into studying Buddhism specifically, let me think back. Well, when I went to university, I went to Sarah Lawrence College, just in the New York City orbit there. And while I was there, there was a professor known as Griffith Folk, T. Griffith Folk. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Griffith Folk is still there, but he joined the college while I was there during the same time. And I was sort of interested in Buddhism and religion in general, and here was someone with expertise in the area. So I asked him, and he agreed to do a year of independent study in Buddhist studies with me during my senior year there at college. And so that really was where I started to cut my teeth on academic Buddhist studies. After I graduated, I moved down to New York City proper, and pretty quickly got a job with Tricycle, which is one of the big sort of mainstream Buddhist, American Buddhist publications. I think the fact that I had a bit of academic Buddhist studies was one of the things that intrigued them about my application. And while I was there, you know, I started exploring the various Buddhist centers in New York City. And I became interested in this sort of question of what's going on with Buddhism in the United States. Of course, everything I had studied up to that time was Asian Buddhism. That's still the backbone, of course, of Buddhist studies as a discipline. But I started thinking, you know, one of the big questions, one of the classic questions in the study of Buddhism, is how Buddhism went at one point from being an Indian religion to being a Chinese religion. You know, ancient India, ancient China being dramatically different cultures and civilizations. How is it that Buddhism went from being such an Indic religion to being such a quintessentially Chinese religion as well? And so it's just part of Chinese culture these days. What was that process there? This is something that, of course, many people have investigated. And it's still an interesting question to many people in the field. But I started noticing how we were kind of living through the same sort of process here as Buddhism went from being an Asian religion to being a North American religion. So that process of evolution adaptation was very, very interesting to me. And, you know, we made the mistake of not having a significant number of trained anthropologists and ethnographers on the ground back in ancient China as it was becoming a Chinese religion. So we kind of missed the boat on that one, and we have to just work with fragmentary textual evidence and other things like that. But I thought, well, here's our chance to begin cataloging this sort of process as it actually happens, you know, live in front of our eyes. And to the extent that I can catalog all this Buddhist stuff that's going on here, maybe 300 years from now, some other, you know, scholar will be able to read back through the stuff I collected, and they'll be able to figure out this process much better because somebody was documenting it at the time. Of course, this led me in a couple directions. One, it, of course, led me to read the other people who were working in this field, such as Charles Prebisch and other people who were publishing around this time in the mid and later 90s. And it also led me just out into the field itself. And I ended up writing a book called The Buddhist Guide to New York, where I went and visited many of the 300 or so Buddhist groups and temples in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut area, and produced this book just kind of on my own. It wasn't a scholarly book, and I at that time had no intention of going to grad school. It was a kind of a foreign idea to me. I was just doing this because I thought, hey, let's do this project and make that information available, not just to people in New York at that time, but make it available so that somebody a few hundred years from now will be able to pick up that book and say, okay, this is the snapshot of what Buddhism looked like in New York at that time. And now here, you know, as I'm sitting in my, you know, office at the University of Mars, I can see how Buddhism has changed since then in the New York area. And, you know, they might get something out of that. Anyway, so I did that project on my own. That was just an independent project. Published that book with St. Martin's Press. And then I happened to move to North Carolina, to Chapel Hill, where my grandmother was living, and moved in to take care of her. And then I happened to run into a scholar who was there teaching at Chapel Hill named Thomas Tweed. And Tom Tweed, of course, is someone who wrote a very influential, important book about the sort of the first stages of American Buddhism back in the 19th century and very early 20th century. And, you know, we just fell to talking, and somehow I ended up applying to the graduate school and was accepted there into the PhD program. So I studied with Tom Tweed and also down the road with Richard Jaffe at Duke because those programs, the Duke and Chapel Hill PhD programs, share a lot of their resources with one another. And did this project on, my master's work, the thesis I did for them, was the first initial work I did with this Ekoji Buddhist Sangha of Richmond, which is at the heart of this Dixie Dharma book. But I moved on to a different project for my PhD, working on the American adaptations of Japanese post-abortion rituals, and then moved on to other projects afterwards. But even though I had done the thesis and then published back, I still continued to visit with Ekoji and continued to collect ethnographic data with them. And now, in the meantime, I moved out to California, to Los Angeles, where my wife took a job at UCLA. I started thinking, now I've seen Buddhism in New York, and I've seen it in the South, such as there is, and now I've seen it in Los Angeles, which makes even New York look like, you know, it doesn't have as much Buddhism and as much Buddhist diversity. So I really began, because of these different life experiences of living in different places, I began to notice how Buddhism was so different in many, many different parts of America, and how this master narrative of American Buddhism, which was evolving out of the scholarship that Prebisch and Tweed and others were doing during this time period, all very good work, very important work. But in a way, we kept talking about American Buddhism, just this kind of, static way that it was, there was one thing called American Buddhism, or there was maybe one thing that that Buddhism in America was evolving towards, or people were seeking. And I just started noticing it's just so different to be a Buddhist in the South than it is to be one in New York. And even in Los Angeles, the Buddhism there is different from the Buddhism in New York, even within the same lineage. So these were the things that set me off on that regionalist path. And what do you know? Eventually, I decided to develop this book project out of that observation.
So that's a great segue into the book. Then the idea of regionalism, I think, is one of the major contributions this book makes to the field of American Buddhist studies or Buddhism in the West, or however we want to frame that. And I think it's interesting your comment about earlier scholarship that tries to figure out what this thing American Buddhism is, as if there's one thing. And I feel like this is related to as you're also saying about how there's a sort of quintessentially Chinese, that Chinese religion is part of, or Buddhism is part of Chinese religion. So we can have this sort of Chinese Buddhism versus American Buddhism versus Japanese Buddhism. And I feel like you've hinted at that in this book, as perhaps one of the things that's lacking in the study of American Buddhism, that we're looking for a sort of unique American Buddhism, and the regionalism trope, contradicts that. So, without further ado, please give us your methodological perspective here about regionalism and where it comes from, because it definitely comes from outside of Buddhist studies proper. Am I correct?
Yeah, I would say that regional studies for me is connected to American religious history, mm-hmm. which officially is the discipline that I was trained in at UNC and Duke. I also did significant coursework and other work in Buddhist studies as well, and my position is in East Asian religion here at the University of Waterloo. But, you know, Tom Tweed and others who I was working with, at the end of the day, they're Americanists, and that was their own training. And the study of regional influences on religion in the United States, this is a venerable sort of approach here. It goes back to the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And people were talking at that time, you know, certainly you had the frontier. This was one of the things people looked at, and how as the frontier moved westward, how religion was changed in that experience. People, of course, looked at religion in the North versus the South. And there was this thing, you may have heard about it, the Civil War, where religion played a major a part and was quite different. Even the same religions, you know, Methodism, Presbyterianism, Baptism, and so on, they schismed North and South and had different practices because of different regional cultural influences upon those same religions. Of course, New England, where I was born and grew up, that's been a region, a definable region for a long time. And so I, you know, already had some of that thinking in there as well. And my family is Southern by heritage, so you know, bouncing back and forth between New England and the South for the school year versus, you know, vacation times, you know, you become aware also of what a regional thing American culture is, and therefore what a regional thing American religion is. Many scholars have noted this, but I didn't see it appearing very commonly, and certainly to no level of sort of thorough investigation in the work on American Buddhism. And I think that's because most of the people who are doing those studies were trained in Buddhist studies or in Asian studies or some cognate field like that. They had very sophisticated things to say about Buddhist phenomena in that way, but they didn't have the training in American religious history. They just had experience with American religion, which sometimes served them well, and other times, of course, there might have been blind spots. So I wanted to bring to bear this trope that comes out of American religious history, which, of course, is primarily focused on the study of Christianity, and then apply it to Buddhism or Buddhist studies. So these seem like two very different fields, American religious history on the one hand, Buddhist studies on the other hand. But I really like to pilfer from both of them and find out what sort of creative things come about through the sort of conjunction of these two fields. Anyway, so looking at regionalism in American Buddhism, that's what I'm doing now in order to show us how there is indeed Buddhism operating on, I would say, many different levels. actually, maybe this is an important point that I should make at this moment. It isn't that all Buddhism is always and only and most importantly regional. That's not my argument. It's just that regions often come to play an important role in the Buddhism that's going on. Mm. So you can look at American Buddhism in the mass sense. You can look at it on a national level. And there are times when that's certainly appropriate to do. You can also look at it, of course, in the transnational sense. And it's important to do so sometimes for some studies. And then you can look at it at the intensely local level as well. Sometimes that matters. But people have talked about it in these kind of various ways. They tend to talk about it at the national and more recently the transnational level. Very occasionally talk about it at the micro local level. But we never talked about the regional. So to me, there was a fundamental piece of the puzzle that was missing. So I'm not looking to supplant national or especially transnational narratives of American Buddhism, but rather to say, hold on, this situation is even more complicated than we're acknowledging right now. We need to look down at the regional level and see what's going on there as well. So I hope that we'll continue to carry out research at all these various levels and to see how really Buddhist groups are impacted by forces that are operating at all of these levels. Every temple exists in a certain place, and that means the very local things come to bear on it. That place, of course, is part of a region, and cultural environmental and other regions in the U.S. can be very impactful on American religion, including Buddhism. So we need to pay attention to those. But, of course, they're also subject to federal laws and things going on at the national cultural level. And, of course, Buddhism is always transnational as well. So there's all these different flows that we need to account for. And I'm just trying to bring our gaze to bear on one that thus far nobody's investigated.
Yeah, well, I'm totally with you. I mean, in my own studies, I think that it's important to look at these various levels. And we do ourselves a disservice by being too rigid in our methodologies and just sticking to one narrative. So I greatly appreciate that you're bringing this other lens onto the study of Buddhism in the U.S. Earlier you mentioned the sort of regions that we all know, like New England or the South. Do you have regions for American Buddhists?
Yeah, I do. Because this is a first attempt to describe what those might be, I've made a suggestion about how we might carve up United States into seven or eight different regions. But then in the book, as soon as I've done that, I then immediately offer some other possibilities. And I think in the conclusion, I offer yet some other possibilities. And the reason for that is that regions are formed, of course, because of conditions that exist in those areas. But at the same time, regions are always, of course, a product of what we're looking for in the first place. That's true at the national level. That's true at the regional level. So we could draw various different regions depending on what factors or influences are most interesting to us or what are most useful in whatever study we're doing at the time. So I'm not trying to suggest that, you know, this is exactly the way that we must carve up the U.S. into Buddhist regions, and that this is the way everyone should use regions for their particular project. But I thought I needed to provide some sort of initial map that we can use, and then we can always adapt the, you know, move the lines and adapt the types of regions we're looking for to suit everybody's different projects that they're doing. If I haven't made it clear already, I'm not... in this project or in other projects, I'm not inclined to argue for master narratives or this is the way. Rather, to me, theories such as regionalism and the other theories that we work with also, two Buddhisms, three Buddhisms, all these various things that come up in the study of American Buddhism, the utility is in their application. Hmm. So, for some projects, they have powerful, you know, explanatory, usage. And for other projects, they're just not as useful. It's not that there are only two Buddhisms or only three Buddhisms or only five Buddhisms or, you know, whatever. It's that always these are a product of what we're looking for. And mm-hmm. It's the same with regions as well. So that's not a problem unless we, I'll pull out a, you know, Buddhist trope here, unless we become deeply attached to this is the way it is and how we must do it and we refuse to change it. But as long as we just bring these different theories to bear in however way is appropriate to the particular project we're doing, then these become very useful. The more theories, the better, as far as I'm concerned, because each of them will illuminate something that the others might not, right?
Mm-hmm.
So back to the regions, though. That's what you asked me. What sort of regions do I propose? Well, obviously the West Coast, that's going to be a pretty obvious region. And Buddhism in that area tends to be relatively strong, tends to have a relatively longer history, tends to have a relatively more diverse Buddhist ecosystem, if you will. It is, of course, physically more proximate to Asia, where Buddhism is strongest. It tends to have the largest, or one of the largest Asian American populations, and so on and so on and so on. So this is a pretty obvious region, and many other places in the U.S. differ from the West Coast in terms of their Buddhist phenomena, and therefore you need to call it out as a specific place. Rather than making the West Coast representative of American Buddhism, again, that big category there, which is a lot of what we were doing before. Most of our studies, most of our ethnographies, whether they were published in a book form or whether they're just theses or dissertations that haven't ever reached that wider audience, as well as many of our articles and things like that in the field, much of the field work tends to be done on the West Coast. It's pretty obvious why that might be. But then when we use that to represent American Buddhism, we can be in real trouble because they're representing almost like an ideal state for American Buddhism there, for Buddhism in the U.S., something that the large majority of Americans live in somewhere very differently, very different from the West Coast in terms of the amount of Buddhism that's available at their fingertips, or at least within a reasonable drive. So the West Coast, obviously, that's got to be one. Another one I suggest is the mountains, which is kind of like the next one over, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is an area that, being next to the West Coast, also early had some Asian migration into that area. Generally, this is an area which we see significantly less Buddhist representation. Also, environmentally, it tends to be its own sort of unique corridor there, you know, the Rockies and their foothills and such. So that, you know, just environmentally, I think has an influence on religion. And so it's something we should pay attention to. I also talk about the Southwest as being yet another sort of separate area. Again, environmentally, it's different, but also the mix of Buddhisms tends to be different there as well. This is one place that a lot of Buddhist retreat centers are being developed. Some of them, you know, out in the desert, away from everybody else. There's some significant ones, even including, of course, the Diamond Mountain one, which is recently in the news because of a unfortunate event which occurred there. So this is an area also that many Buddhist, possibly with the New Age influences, have come to see that area as kind of an inherently sort of power place, or spiritual area. I note that back when Tricycle was doing their so-called Buddha bus tours of American Buddhism, that's the region that they chose to target as a place to market Buddhist tourism in the U.S. So seems to be its own sort of region. Then we have the plains. Again, this is, I guess we're basically moving more or less eastward here. The narrative of American Buddhism usually moves from east to west, but the narrative of American Buddhism, as Laurie Maffley-Kipp, a scholar, once noted, tends to move from west to east. So we've got the plains, environmentally very different from the regions we just talked about. And in terms of Buddhists, well, there's really not so many of them. Now we've really sort of taken a real nosedive in terms of the numbers and diversity of Buddhist groups that are represented in that area. There are some that are there, certainly. Everywhere you go in the U.S. these days, you look hard enough, you can find some Buddhists or some Buddhist influence, at least. But the plains are mostly a pretty big empty space for Buddhist groups compared to certainly the West Coast, but even to the Southwest and other places. I also talk about the Midwest as another Buddhist region. This is a place where, certainly centering on the urban Midwest, places such as Chicago, there has been since the 19th century a pretty good Buddhist presence there, and a particular diversity of groups that have come up there. And of course, we need to have the Northeast, which I tend to sort of draw a line, not just New England, but the Northeast, you know, including New York State, New England, going down the Atlantic seaboard, down to, you know, approximately maybe D.C. And maybe even the northern Virginia suburbs around D.C., Alexandria, and that sort of thing. That, to me, is another region. It's the furthest away from the from Asia. It has a different sort of ethnic mix. It has, in general, people like to say that has a relatively liberal sort of cultural, social, and political stance. So that certainly affects things. And one thing I should note is that these regions I'm talking about, often they have particular Buddhist regional networks that have grown up in them. That's one reason why I'm carving things this way. When you look, for instance, at the Midwest, there's a number of lineages that have primarily spread in the north, in the Midwest, from places that you know, coming radiating out of Chicago, or in some cases out of the Rochester Zen Center and places like that, moving through the Great Lakes area and forming particular local networks of these lineages. Same with the Southwest, we find groups that are there that don't have much presence elsewhere, and so on. Obviously, the South is going to be a big one for me and for my particular studies here, since that's where I've done so much of my field work, especially for this project. The South, what can we say? Not a lot of Buddhists, not a lot of Asian Americans, although that has changed somewhat in recent years, but it still lags behind other areas. And the surrounding religious culture is very noticeable, and it directly impacts the Buddhists in many cases who live in that region. You know, Southern religion is changing. It is more diverse than a lot of people realize, but it's still strongly evangelical Protestant. Mm-hmm. And that's an evangelical Protestantism that actively, robustly, confidently pushes itself at all times into the public sphere so that it is inescapable. Christianity, including evangelical Christianity, is present in all the areas we've talked about. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for most people on the West Coast, it's not a really daily reality. Or for people in, you know, in the Northeast or something like that, evangelical Protestantism is a pretty daily reality if you live in the South, especially in many particular regions there. So, go right ahead, Scott.
So then, while we finally reach the South, what is it about the South that you think creates a unique Buddhism of the South? What is it about the Buddhism that's there that makes it different, noticeably different, or in practice, or whatnot, from other parts of the country?
Okay, well, there's kind of a lot of different factors. Some of them.
I know it's not an easy question, but.
I say the South, and in the book, I immediately break it into the coastal South and these are just terms I'm coming up with. Sometimes the coastal South may be a couple hundred miles inland. So, you know, descriptive in a very broad sense, since this is, again, our first preliminary work on regionalism, especially Southern Buddhism here. But in general, here's what we can say about Buddhism in the South. It exists in a sea of evangelical Protestantism in a way that most other places don't really manifest that. It exists in a place where religion is very much in the public sphere and where the first question that a stranger is quite likely to ask you is, what church do you go to? There's really not a lot of other places in the U.S. where that's really quite possibly the first question you'll get out of someone, especially if you've just moved to the neighborhood, to the town, and just taken a job. People will go ahead and ask you about that sort of stuff. It's a basic way of forming social attachments, is to inquire about people's churches, and it begins to fit them into your sort of mental map as a Southerner to try to figure out who this new person is and how you should relate to them. It's not simply, they're not necessarily trying to push their religion on you. Rather, you know, in some ways they're looking for a way to, find common ground with you so that you can begin to form a friendship in this sort of way. Anyways, there's very much that public Christianity you have to deal with. Other things, you have a different racial mix in the South than in many places. And you especially have a very particular racial history. Mm. This is manifest in a few ways. Of course, we have the history of, you know, sort of intense slavery. There was slavery in many parts of the U.S., but the South really developed it as an entire way of life, centered, a culture centered around the industry of slavery. Then you had legal segregation and the battles to protect that. These really influenced the culture in particular ways. And even though, of course, that legal segregation is pretty much behind us at this point, there's many repercussions that lead up to the present. We shouldn't stereotype the South, of course, as being monolithically racist, repressive, or somehow intensely worse than the rest of the U.S., even on the West, which I just characterize as relatively, you know, almost paradise for American Buddhism in some ways. There's a long, long history of exclusion and oppression of Asian Americans and their particular religious traditions on the West Coast. Nonetheless, we have to say the South, well,
it's a different history.
Southerners have often been quite proud of. Yeah. I say this as someone with a very long Southern lineage in my own family, including some of the people who, fought on the losing side. So, you know, I've observed these people and lived amongst them and have some sense for how they understand the South. Another thing that's different, of course, is the relatively low level of Asian Americans, the particular mix of Asian Americans and their religions that we see. For instance, the Gulf Coast, lots of Vietnamese in that area. This is one of the primary places for Vietnamese Americans to settle or to migrate to, is the Gulf Coast. Not the only one, of course. We see people in California and other places, but that part of the South, very much so. And again, there are particular networks of Buddhist groups in the South that you don't necessarily find in other parts of the U.S. And then on the other hand, many of the groups that we think of as the representatives of American Buddhism, such as the San Francisco Zen Center and Shambhala and such like these, many of them are relatively weak in the South. So they turn out to be, rather than American Buddhisms, they turn out to be regional American Buddhisms themselves once we look at the South, when we realize that San Francisco Zen Center, the Suzuki lineage, is so poorly represented in the South, which is an enormous geographic area, also a very large population area. And yet there's only just a handful of Suzuki teachers publicly teaching in that area compared to the dozens and dozens and dozens that we can find in California and other regions. Mm-hmm. So there's many that produce this particular sort of South. We can, of course, talk about the climate as well. Climate and topography and all these things have a real impact on how religions play out, and there's, you know, it's hot. It's just hotter, apparently. So that influences things as well. Or we can say in colder regions, they're influenced in ways that the Southern Buddhists don't have to take into account. This is not the entirety. There's other reasons I discuss in the book, but just to give you some examples of things that are different about the Southern Buddhist experience or Southern Buddhist context that I think are worth noting.
Mm-hmm. So then to take this even further, the heart of your book is an ethnographic survey of the Ekoji Sangha in Richmond, Virginia. So to give our listeners some understanding, the Ekoji Sangha is really quite unique and special in a lot of ways compared to, you know, the Buddhism that I experience on a day-to-day basis here in California, in that there are many different groups that cohabit the same space. So tell us a little bit about the history of this group and how it came to be, how it ended up in Virginia of all places, and who these different groups are who practice together, or not together, as the case may be, in this one physical location.
Okay, very good. So this book, Dixie Dharma, it's based on sort of field work done at a number of different levels. So at the heart of it is this long-term ethnographic research on this multi-denominational Buddhist temple, the Okoji Buddhist Sangha of Richmond, Virginia. Richmond is the capital of Virginia. It was the capital of the Confederacy back during the Civil War and so on. So it has a particular identity even within the region of the South. It's a place where Southern culture and Southern traditions are especially held up. So there is the investigation of that particular temple, which happens to have multiple groups at it, very interesting. And then, of course, I've investigated Buddhism in Richmond more widely. I've visited all the Buddhist groups there multiple times. I've investigated Buddhism more broadly in Virginia and in the Southeast, in North Carolina and other places, and then, of course, throughout the South. But I would say, sort of these are, as the circles expand, there's less and less intense field work at each level. So here are the Koji. This is where I've really put in the most hours and the most investigation. So what is this temple? Well, it started off as a Jodo Shinshu Pure Land temple in the Buddhist Churches of America's tradition. Back in the early 1980s, Bishop Kinryu Tsuji, who was one of the most important and long-serving bishops of the BCA, he retired at the end of the 1970s, and he moved to the Washington, D.C. area. So he found the first BCA temple in the South in that area. Even though he was an older person by this time, he was retiring from being a bishop and everything. He'd had a long career in various places, starting in Canada. He was originally Canadian. He still had this drive for, what would you call it? Evangelizing, as opposed to missionizing. He was a missionary priest, as there have been a great many missionary Buddhists in the past. So he recognized that there was no Buddhist temple, no BCA temple, in the Washington area, so in the area of the nation's capital. And that in general, BCA, while very strong in the West, was very weak in the East. So he moved out there and he got this temple started in the Virginia suburbs of BC. So this was the first BCA temple in that area. Well, once he got to that area and founded that temple, he began to think about Buddhism in the South in general and how there were no BCA temples there. Indeed, back in the early, mid-1980s, very few Buddhist temples anywhere in the South. Hmm. Naturally, because he was there, the Buddhists who did exist started to send requests to the Northern Virginia Temple. Now that it was publicly available and people could kind of see that, oh, there's a minister there and we could maybe have him come visit us. So he started to, he basically transformed himself into a Buddhist circuit rider. Just like the old Methodists and other circuit riders of the 19th century who spread evangelical religion throughout the U.S. and especially through the South. So he would periodically go to all these different places in the South where there were a few Buddhists at least who had written to him and said, hey, if you come through our town, we'll put you up and we'll get some friends together and we'll hold a Buddhist service and we'll discuss the Dharma here. So the first place where this occurred was in Richmond. Richmond's about three and a half hours, I guess, south of Washington, D.C. It really depends on what the traffic's like, really. It can be pretty bad. So it's a few hours anyways, let's say, from Washington. And so he would drive down there and meet with these Buddhists in Richmond who had reached out to him. They didn't typically have their own temple or anything there. And at first they were actually meeting over at the Quaker meeting house because the Quakers would give him some space for free. And he would meet with them. And he would go on deeper into the South. He could see North Carolina, then down to Georgia, Florida, and eventually go out to Texas. And making this big circuit, this big loop, meeting with Buddhists in these areas and sort of counseling them, and then he'd return back up to Northern Virginia and start it all over again. So in Virginia, in Richmond, rather, they got enough people together that they thought, well, hey, we'll be able to found a second temple here, and we'll call it a Koji. And they got some money from some philanthropic Buddhists on the West Coast connected with BCA. They were able to buy a house and set up a BCA temple. And that was their idea. This is going to be the first temple that was basically not on a Japanese-American cultural or ethnic base, because all the other temples in BCA had at least begun as Japanese-American, very strongly Japanese-American temples. But there are very few Japanese-Americans in Richmond, especially in the 1980s. And so they were starting up with mostly, you know, a bunch of Euro-Americans, many of them of quite venerable Southern extraction there. So they started this, what we might call a white, you know, Pure Land temple there. And after a few years, they started to invite other groups to visit the temple and to actually attend the temple with them. So a Zen group got started there because, if you think about it, Reverend Tsuji was only coming through Richmond maybe a couple times a month, right? So most of the time, the temple wasn't really being used. So the Zen group started using it on an alternate day, on Sunday mornings, actually. And then eventually, then a Tibetan group got started there. And so on and so on. And they have a Vipassana group that came and joined them. So that because they planted this temple there, and because they were willing to share this space, which was, you know, relatively underused during the course of the entire week, because there was no local minister, there was only a guy who came through town occasionally, that set up this situation where you had all these Buddhist groups sharing one temple. These days, there's five of them, as a matter of fact. They have the original Pure Land group, which is sort of transformed from being Jōbu Shinshu into a more generic kind of Pure Land temple with a Pure Land group with many Chinese influences. And they have a Karmakagyu Tibetan group, a Soto Zen group, which is affiliated with the San Francisco Zen Center. And they have a Vipassana group. And these days they have a kind of a non-denominational meditation group, somewhat based on Tony Packer's style of sort of post-Zen meditation coming out of her Springwater Retreat Center in upstate New York. So you got five groups, one temple. They all share that temple. All their donations go into that temple, and they share it together. Quite an unusual situation. But I think part of it is because of the region. You had all these little Buddhist groups that could not survive on their own. None of them were large enough to rent or own their own spaces anywhere. But to put together collectively, they could maintain this space. And they also share a lot of membership amongst each other. So together, they create a sort of critical mass. And they're pushed together because they find that as Buddhists in the South, even though they're very different types of Buddhism, being Buddhist makes them all much more similar to each other than they are to any of the Christians who are their neighbors and this sort of thing. So that in other places where they might say, I am Zen and I'm going to do Zen and this is going to be a group of Zen people and we're going to go off and do our own sort of thing. Here, they really are pushed to look for commonalities rather than distinctiveness. And because they often visit each other's groups, often they're members of multiple groups, they start to develop kind of hybrid practices in this shared space here, which I think are rather interesting.
So that's raises my next question. What do you think some of the implications are to the way Buddhism is practiced when you have this sort of hybridity and, as you call it, pluralism in this one community? How does that change people's perspective or practices?
Well, it certainly does affect them pretty directly. Now, not every single member of this temple is going to have a hybrid practice. Some people only go to one group. They prefer to stick with one group. They often have already connections in the same lineage outside of the Virginia area, even outside of the South. So, for instance, they moved from the San Francisco Bay Area to Richmond to take a job, perhaps, and they were all associated with the San Francisco Zen Center. So that's what's really comfortable to them, and so they're going to go to that Soto Zen group that meets at a Koji, and they're going to be less likely to go attend one of the other groups, because to them, Pure Land Buddhism or Tibetan Buddhism, just a big question mark. It's not their thing. So you absolutely have that as one type of experience in this. I mean, not everybody's a hybrid Buddhist. Not everyone's a pluralistic Buddhist. But on the other, many other people at this sort of temple do attend other groups because they're right there in their physical proximity. I mean, some of their same friends are going to the other groups. The of these groups is lying all around everywhere, so you can't avoid it. The icons of the different groups are all grouped together on the mantle, on the altar, all these places there in the temple. So you encounter it continuously, and if you're a bit open to it or whatever circumstances drive you towards it, you very easily begin to mix and adapt the different types of Buddhisms into your personal practice. So that there's people there, for example, who in their daily practice, perhaps, they'll get up in the morning and they may sit zazen in a soto, shikan taza manner for a while. And then they may begin to do their Tibetan-derived prostration practices and mantras and this sort of thing. And then afterwards, maybe they'll do a bit of a metta, loving-kindness meditation that they learned from the Insight Meditation Group. And this would be what their daily practice looks like. It's all together. And they don't easily tease these strands out either. It's even a bit of artificial for me to say, well, this is the Soto Zen segment of their day, and this is the Tibetan segment of their practice and everything. We can trace out where those things originally came from. But once they become in conversation with each other, within the body or practice or mind of that same person, they begin to blend in ways where it becomes much harder to say what's exactly discreetly one element of one thing or another. So then, of course, these people who have exposure to more than one thing, they attend other groups, or they at least go out to dinner with friends who are in other groups. The temple's a real place to socialize as well. And they naturally talk about what they're doing. So that even if I'm a member of, let's say, the Zen group, and I never go to the Tibetan group, nonetheless, other people on Sunday morning sitting facing the wall on the zafus, some of those other people are the Tibetan group or the Pilan group or whatever. And when we have our book discussion afterwards, even if we're discussing, say, the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Patriarch, people bring perspectives to bear on it, and I will hear them and be exposed to them. Or Pureland Buddhist perspectives and this sort of thing. So naturally, you get this kind of hybridity that develops. And then the interesting thing about this pluralism is that it comes about originally just because of circumstances. Financial circumstances, low membership numbers, and other things drive the Buddhists together out of necessity. They're not there because they said, oh, I need to find a temple with five different groups. I refuse to go to any group that has meeting there. They go there because of circumstances. And yet over time, existing in this area where they rub up against each other, come to positively evaluate this sort of thing. So they become pluralistic in their attitudes, not just the sort of bare fact of their practice. So they come to say, Buddhism is best practiced for multiple lineages. And the best way to pursue the Dharma is all the different Dharma doors and try to combine them in some way which works best. And Buddhism should be pluralistic, and it should we should think about Buddhism broadly and everyone being in the same Buddhist family rather than being attached to our particular lineage or teacher or something like that. So there's an attitude shift that occurs here, not just a practice shift. But the funny thing is that we often assume that the attitude might lead people into pursuing multiple Dharma doors and therefore developing a hybrid practice. It seems to actually often operate in the opposite way. People become hybrid, whether they notice it or not, and then they are led into pluralistic attitudes as an evolution of that fact.
So I wanted to have you speak a little bit about one of the last chapters of the book is particular kind of practice that I think is most obviously, to the casual reader anyway, something that could only happen in the South, and that is this event that was the slave trade meditation vigil. This chapter I found to be extremely powerful and moving, just in terms of the motivations behind this practice. And, you know, again, I think this really speaks to something that can only happen in the South, right? So if you could just walk us through what the slave trade meditation vigil was, and is this something that happens continually? Is it still happening now, or was it just a one-time thing? And what kind of influences this might have on how Buddhism is practiced in the South?
Very good. Okay. So I do think this is very particularly this ritual, but it's also immediately you can see the connections to other sorts of similar rituals that have occurred or do occur elsewhere. So the slave trade meditation vigil is a particular meditation vigil that Ekoji performed in 2008, in a few years. They haven't repeated it since then, so it's not clear whether this will be an ongoing practice or not. It was something that was very noteworthy for the temple at the time. Many people have talked about it since then. Had a big impact, not just on the people who went there, but you know, it's something that many people in the larger sangha have discussed, you know, over time. And I think there is some interest in repeating it, but logistically, it's not always easy to put these together. So let's talk about this event that they did do. So these sort of meditation vigils are bearing witness events. Another term for them are something that we see coming out of the general sense of engaged Buddhism that we often find in Buddhism in North America. And in this particular case, though, the people at Ekoji decided that they would do a meditation vigil specifically around the fact of slavery, or I should say, the legacy of slavery. Because Richmond used to be one of the most important slave markets in the entire South. In general, it was a place of slavery. So this was certainly regional in terms of the whole South as having this long slave history, and it was sort of locally regionally as well, because Richmond and this part of Virginia was very much a nexus of the slave trade. So some of the people there at Ekoji began thinking about this and wanted to do something to deal with that fact of historical slavery and the ongoing legacy of slavery, and we should say segregation, Jim Crow, all just the discrimination that has occurred in this area. And it's an interesting story, actually, because one of the people who initiated this was a teacher who would visit the temple occasionally, rather than being actually on site. Ekoji has no permanent ministers or monks or priests or clergy of any type. So they would have this guy coming in occasionally from outside of the region, but he observed the way in which there was a particular regional, story of suffering. And he became intrigued about that, and as the people discussed it, they had this idea of doing the meditation vigil. So let me describe what it was. Basically, a number of people, about a dozen or so from the temple, walked along a historic slave trail. They started across the James River at the site where slaves would have been unloaded after being brought up the river. They would be unloaded, then they'd be forced in chains along this trail, which still exists, and up over the river to the other side, and then to downtown Richmond, where there were a bunch of slave jails and slave auction houses there. So they'd be sold off, just separated from their families and such, and dispersed throughout the South to be slaves in different areas. So, and this was, there's slave markets in many places, but this is one of the major ones for the entire region. So many, many, many people came through there. And I mean, this was a major industry for Richmond, slavery and slave auctioning. So the meditators gathered one Saturday morning at the disembarking site for the slaves, and then they walked single file line along the slave trail as you go through some woods currently, and then along the next to the river and then over a bridge. They walked silently, doing silent sort of Zen-type walking meditation, and they were wearing typically their rock shoes, either a type of Zen small vestment that many people who've taken vows wear. Not all the people were Zen, but many of them were. So they had those sort of vestments on, and they walked silently along the trail and over into downtown Redmond, down to a place where they've now the city has set up what they call a slave reconciliation site, their slave trade memorial. And they have a big statue carved out of this sort of a black rock of two humanoid figures embracing. It's somewhat abstract, but it clearly looks like two figures embracing each other. And there's a little patch of grass there, and there's some plaques that describe the slave trade and everything. And it's this sort of slave trade memorial park that they've set up there. And so the people meditated, walked along the slave trail, then sat down in front of the statue. They used the statue as their gohonzon, their image of sort of worship or veneration or object of focus. Held a service there. They offered some flowers and some incense in front of it, as if it were a Buddha statue, and did some chanting of Buddhist scriptures there. And they all sat in a circle, more or less, there on the grass, and they held a meditation vigil all day long, where they sat there, and they were bearing witness to or acknowledging the historic fact and effects of that slave trade and the ongoing discrimination against African Americans. And this went on, like I say, all day, and then at the end they broke up, and then the next day they had a discussion about it at the Okoji Temple. So many additional people beyond the ones who just were actually there on that Saturday morning, many others heard about it and got to learn about the experience. Many of the participants I talked to found this to be a very moving, very important practice for them. And of course, as they're sitting there, you have people walking by all the time. This is downtown in a busy area. Even though it was Saturday, there were many people around, some of whom stopped for a while and meditated with them or talked with them about what was going on. So it had a wider public presence, and the temple often takes. People often seek to kind of fly under the radar because they're sometimes don't have the some of their Christian neighbors are uncomfortable with the Buddhists, and some of the Buddhists are afraid of what Christians might say or about them or even do to them. So they don't often look to have a very public face. This was quite a public event, but in a low-key sort of way. We're just meditating. We're not, shouting and carrying signs and this sort of thing. But it was a way of acknowledging that Southern history and trying to sort of process it. Anyways, that's what it was. And I can, of course, go into further detail about various aspects of it. But let me take a pause here.
No, please. I think this is, again, I think it was a very interesting, that's one of the things I think is interesting is that in the book you do talk a lot about how, as a consequence of living in a predominantly evangelical Christian environment, many of the folks are not openly Buddhist, so to speak. And yet here there was this moment where they were very, very open and very, very public, which is very, I think has clear implications on how they expressed themselves, in a very, uniquely Southern way, I think.
Yeah, we find these meditation vigils, in other forms and other places. So, for example, at concentration camps in Poland, a number of these bearing witness ones. Sometimes there's some relationship to kind of the street retreats that Bernie Glassman Roshi has done in New York City. He also does some of the ones in Europe. Sometimes you see meditation retreats in the Bay Area, at some of the prisons and this sort of thing. But this idea of a slave trade meditation vigil, this, like I said, there was slavery all over the place, and yet this is very clearly tied to the local, regional history. It's from that that emerges the need for this sort of thing. I mean, how many, you might have had an underground railroad meditation vigil in the north somewhere, that would have a rather different flavor than one that is meditating on the fact of the incredible, you know, crushing, violent, dehumanizing history, much of it religious history, that, that has taken place right there on that, you know, plot of ground and in the surrounding parts of the South there. It's something that people felt that they needed to acknowledge, needed to deal with. Many of them had very emotional experiences. If you think about it, meditation as a, which was the primary practice they did. Of course, they also had a service and they had some discussion and everything. The primary thing they did was silent meditation. There's often a stereotype of it as, a rather dull sort of, experience. You know, you don't, hopefully you're not thinking a lot and you're trying to clear your mind and it's, not, not an emotional experience necessarily. There was, again, sort of stereotypes here. But many of these people reported very emotional, very strong reactions. Some of them felt that as the day went on, they began to experience some sort of lingering echoes of the slave experience there. People discussed with me how they heard they heard the sound of whips and they heard people crying out in this sort of way. Whether, however we want to, categorize these, whether they were, imaginary phenomena or sympathetic phenomena or somehow actually tapping into some sort of, you know, previous or ongoing, you know, effect on the area. And, you know, I leave it to everyone else to decide for themselves what they want to make of this. But, the people themselves reported having these experiences during meditation. Some of them became overwhelmed with them, began to cry and, were intensely moved by them, you know, so there was this sort of, emotional energy that developed around meditating in this area on this, regionally important, history, which changed, for some of them, changed the way that they understood themselves as Buddhists and what Buddhist practice is about. And they weren't sitting now just to, you know, decrease their stress or, you know, maybe to achieve some sort of personal insight, but in a way, they were dealing with what they called the reality of their collective karma. Is a phrase I heard some of them use. That there was a collective karma in the South that had to be dealt with, and that somehow meditation and Buddhist practice would help to surface and then deal with, and you know, hopefully positively affect this this collective inherited karma from a. A quite, you know, nasty past that they shared.
Well, again, I think this is great stuff, and the book is a joy to read, and it really pushes the boundaries in terms of the field that I think you and I both care deeply about. So, thank you again for sharing with us. We usually end these interviews with a question about what we can expect from you in the future. If I remember correctly, you are currently working on another book.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, I'm working on a couple of books, and I have a few other projects that are further down the line that are already kind of actively going on. But in particular, my next solo-authored project is currently the title is Mindful America, and it's looking at mindfulness practice. And right now, just in the United States, talking about how mindfulness has become such a pervasive sort of technique. In so many different areas, that it sort of jumped out of the realm of Buddhism, and it's become something, mindfulness practice is something that you find in therapy, you find it in schools, you find it in the prison system, you find it in the court system. Mindfulness is now being taught to soldiers in the U.S. military to help them to deal with post-traumatic stress syndrome, but also in some ways to help make them more efficient carrying out their various missions. You find this mindfulness everywhere. There's mindful eating, mindful parenting, mindfulness at work. There are mindfulness-based divorce lawyers. It's everywhere in the U.S. So I'm writing this book, which looks at that fact that this mindfulness, which is directly derived from Buddhism, this is probably the way that Buddhism has its single largest cultural impact on the United States. And much of it being done by, you know, quote-unquote non-Buddhists. So this is a Buddhist has become kind of like yoga and its ability to move beyond its religious origins and become widely influential. On the other hand, I also want to talk about how Buddhism changes in the U.S. when it is so influenced by these American concerns we're looking to it for. So that now people are doing Buddhism to become better parents and to have better sex and to be a more effective divorce lawyer and all this sort of thing. There's something that changes in Buddhism when these very this worldly concerns are brought to bear on what previously practice for detachment, not for the enhancement of pleasure in eating or sex or something like that, but actually as a way of basically separating yourself from the experience and seeing it for what it was, nothing too special. It was a practice that used to move on towards nirvana rather than to become ever more committed to being a helicopter parent for your 2-year-old or something like that. So I'm writing this book that looks at that very interesting conjunction of American culture and Buddhist mindfulness and how they're altering each other in various ways that might have been rather unexpected. Anyways, that's the major project I'm working on, hopefully that book may be out perhaps next year with Oxford University Press. So that's quite fun to investigate, what can I say?
Yeah, it sounds great. I'm really looking forward to that one, actually. I think we have reached the end of our time together. So I want to say thank you again, Jeff, for speaking with us today, and best of luck in your new projects.
Well, thank you very much, Scott.
Okay, take care.
You've been listening to New Books in Buddhist Studies, and today we've been talking with Jeff Wilson, author of Dixie Dharma, Inside a Buddhist Temple in the American South. I'm your host, Scott Mitchell. Thanks for listening.